Hello, my name is Louise Romanen. Thank you for joining me on my new podcast, Indigo Child. It's a place where I get to explore some of the topics that I love talking about in my live stand-up shows. What would Beyoncé do? Am I right, ladies? Politics for bitches and God is a woman. The language might be a bit colourful, so if you've got little ones nearby, be careful. I want to say a big thank you to all my supporters and my audiences that have helped make this podcast possible, and a huge thank you to all my patrons. And to Bernie, snoring in the background. You might be hearing more from her. Thank you, and I hope you enjoyed this week's episode.
No.
I just realised that I didn't record. I didn't press record, so I've just fucking... Nailing it today, mate. Nailing it today. So I don't suppose you want to say all that again, do you, mate?
Yeah, we'll say it again. go on. I can't remember what you asked me.
Where's comedy stand? So we've had this big there's been lots of revelations recently in stand-up about how sexist it is, how discriminatory it is, how it's been an old men's club for a long, 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 long time. And here's the thing, like, I kind of knew going into it and it was an old boys' club, but I never felt like an outsider in it. Like, I always just felt like, well, for me, with stand-up, if you're funny, you're funny, right? So if you can be part of the team if you're funny. Now, luckily for me, there were lots of clubs and the Free Fringe was the most opening to me, because the Free Fringe, it didn't matter. Like, the Comedy Store was never open to me. Like, that is not somewhere where I ever felt welcomed, wanted to be, ever felt like I belonged there. Like, no chance. And that's probably my own insecurity. And it's just such a, it felt like at the time, I don't know if you've played the Comedy Store, like such an old man's, like, old school club, comedy club, really hardcore, really in your face, really aggressive. Never for me. But there was loads of clubs where I felt totally welcomed, where I could be ridiculous and I could go on in a sparkly bra and just talk shit, or I could go on in the tracksuit bottoms and just talk about, you know, oh, this guy's not text me. And people found it funny. I don't know why. It wasn't, I mean, it was funny 20 years ago, not anymore, mate, but whatever. But we're seeing more and more stories come out. Yeah.
Don't do that. Don't. What you're doing there is you're preempting what the people who would criticize you are saying, and then you're saying it before they say it.
No,
don't do it. But then the people who would criticize you would never have the self-awareness to do that to themselves. And also, it wouldn't matter what you would do as a successful woman, they would always find a way to undermine or operate it. So don't ever give their bullshit any airtime. Like, don't ever reinforce.
You're so right. Do you know what I found as well? Like, I don't know if you found this as well when you first started, because, like, you're doing really well now. Like, and it's weird what people think of success. So, like, people say to me, oh, you're doing really well. And I still think, oh my God, I've still got so much to do. There's so much I want to achieve. There's so much I want to do. But in terms of, I mean, it's successful in terms of I'm not having to do another job. So, like, stand-up is my full-time job. So, you know, in that way, I'm very successful. But I found when I first started, there was lots of support for the underdog, like to do well, to be the underdog, to get far. And then as I started doing well, it was really interesting seeing just the criticism or the folk tales that I'd hear, that I'd be like, where did they get that from? Like, you don't even know me. I've never even met these people. And I see it all the time. The second I see a woman do well, or hear of a woman doing well, or a woman's show is doing really well, or she's getting all this heat, oh, well, yeah, it's because she's with that agent. Oh, well, did you know that that was her boyfriend? Well, did you know that she used to always gig with him all the time? He wrote her jokes for her. Like, yeah. It's incredible to see that. And I don't know where that comes from. And I don't know if it's something you've experienced or are aware of.
I think it's so male and masculine as opposed to male. So there's such an air of, like, toxic masculinity coursing through stand-up. I guess some of its tenets are that of, like, bravado and, you know, all that kind of lying and ambition. So maybe some of it is built into it. So you will be accepted as a woman if you know your place, and you're knowing your place is not doing better than anyone and not having anything that anyone else wants. So as soon as you do that, even if you're like, they can't follow you at a gig, they'll be like, you know, have a go at you for that, for being like, well, you went on and did all that shit, not acknowledging all the hundreds of times we've had to go on after incredibly misogynistic material, or
three, oh my God,
talking about how like the punchline to every joke is how stupid women are, and then you have to go on and be like, I'm one of those stupid women you've heard so much about, right, and like reclaim the space like for yourself. So I just think that it's obviously because it's the trying to be sympathetic and empathetic as well. It's so hard doing this job, even when you are like, I have my dream career, but do I look at other people and think, I want to be doing that, why am I not doing that, and allow it to get, of course it's nearly impossible to run your own race. So what's difficult is people, especially people you started at the same time as, or people you used to look up to, they see what you're doing and it's very hard to go, I'm so pleased for them. It's much easier to take it as a personal attack, your success.
Yeah.
So it's this whole thing of like, unless you stay where you are and you blow them and you still need them and, you know, still look up to them, or are still like, even the acts who like, well, I would always smash it harder in a club. And it's like, great. So that's like, and that's not a non-transferable skill. But so, for instance, with you, you build your shows. And yes, yeah, maybe you found the Comedy Store not your vibe. But that doesn't mean if you can't play the Comedy Store, you don't have a career. It just means that you went, I've got to find a different path and some clubs are going to suit me. And it's so weird because a lot of time we don't ever – I see it in this whole difference that we have between circuit versus fringe, circuit versus fringe. And I always feel like I have a foot in both because I came up through the circuit and now I do fringe shows and I tour. And it's been important to me to do proper shows. Do you know what I mean? Like, again, me saying proper isn't very helpful, but I mean shows about shows that are hard. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's stand-up-y, but it's hard. It's hard to make funny and good, right?
Yeah.
And I see loads of acts being like, oh, it's a TED talk, or where are the laughs, and oh, you've got to pretend you've been raped or whatever to do a show. I never see acts who are fringe weirdos going, oh, what, you do the circuit, oh, you know, you do the Comedy Store. I never see the sort of like
other side,
side of it. So it's like, well, that's their bullshit they're bringing to the table and they're projecting, because what they're seeing is someone who's doing something that they can't do, and rather than going, wow, isn't it amazing that there's so many different skill sets, they're taking it as a personal attack. And that's you can't do anything with people like that until they realize that's what's going on.
Well, I was going to argue, not argue, but I was going to suggest that, is that something that's specific to women more so than men, that affects women more so than men? Because there's with women, I kind of feel like there's this idea that there's only ever room for one. So it's that idea of the panel shows, when panel shows introduced, I think it was the BBC that introduced it first, where they had to have a female in every panel show, which is necessary because you go, you haven't had women on panel shows, but now what you've done is you've made it a token, and rather be there on merit within a token. The audiences know that, everyone knows that, like it's an undue amount of pressure. It's an unnecessary amount of pressure to put on the female. And what you're trying to do then is you're trying to fit square pegs into round holes, right? Because you've got these formats and these shows that have been around for a very, very long time, and they're naturally quite competitive, quite aggressive. And if you're looking at acts that are on the fringe, that I would argue, I know it's broadly speaking, but fringe acts are much more open, heart-led, emotional, feel-good. It's all about the room and the audience. Like, my style and your style of comedy is not attacky. Like, I've never been on stage and been like, oh, look at you, you big dickhead with your weird haircut, and look at you with your weird, you know, size or whatever it is that people want. Like, I'm very much like, hey, I love your weird hair. You're welcome here. Like, look at me. Isn't it crazy? Like, it's much more inclusive. But actually, I think it's a mistake to make it female versus male, even though I see the frustration, because I see who I started with and I see how many of the comics that I started with that now have very secure careers. You know, they're on TV all the time. And if you're talking about security, I guess you're talking about financials, right? Financially. And it is important to talk about that. And I think as a woman, like, maybe whenever I've talked about that, it's been criticized. And I'm like, well, hang on, I want to be financially secure. Like, I want to be financially secure for me and my family. Whereas if a guy say that, it's all about the comedy, it's all about the comedy. Well, of course it's all about the comedy. But when you do comedy, you get financially secure. When I do comedy, I'm still having to work a lot harder to get a fraction of it. And then I see lots of comics that I started with that are male, like working class comics, male working class comics, comics that come from different backgrounds, that have got different accents, comics that come from different ethnicities, and they're not doing as well either. So it's no good me saying, well, it's women against men, because you go, well, I started with all these guys who are brilliant and they're still fucking struggling. And you go, well, there's going to be a self-fulfilling prophecy, because if you keep struggling for years enough, eventually you are just going to become mundane and play the clubs and do the same material, because no one's letting you grow. No one's letting you go to that next level. So it's what's your thoughts?
I think a big problem that we have with television is some of the people making the decisions. Well, this is why representation generally is so important, because people generally, you know, will champion people like them. So yeah. If we have quite an old institution in television, and a lot of the people are at the top making the calls are wealthy, middle-class, white guys, the things that they'll be, that will resonate with them, because it is comedies about, you know, what you can, you know, make people resonate with, will be the people in their own image. So they're less likely to be like, they might be like, oh, I just don't really connect with Louisa's stuff. And what they're saying is like, I'm not Louisa's audience, but that doesn't mean that they shouldn't go, but she has a huge audience. Like if they were smart, they would go, let's bring her audience. Like, cause they're not it's not just middle class white straight men watching television. It's no. Like it's everyone. So I think it's a problem with people championing people like them. And then I think it's
that leads down to, I would argue, I mean, things have changed now since I started. Like when I started, I remember getting so much shit, and now I'm seeing females come through with empowering, fun shows, and they're much more celebrated and female. Whereas when I was doing it back in 2012, it was criticized for being too in your face, like she's too brass, she's too broad, she's too like personal. Whereas now it's like, oh wow, yeah, really celebrate dick jokes. And you go, well, hang on, when I did it, you were very quick to criticize. And I would argue that there's the same with the reviewers. So the shows that are getting reviewed by majority of, I would say, white middle class background. Like I remember doing Beyonce, right? I did Beyonce at Soho Theatre, and I got a standing ovation for like 10 minutes. I fucking nailed it, mate. And my audience were wearing hijabs. They were black, white, Asian, from all over, and it was majority women. It was like 99.9% women, apart from one guy who got brought along by his girlfriend, right? And I loved that show, and I smashed it. And I remember a reviewer came along, really prestigious reviewer. And he said, I was in your face, TMI, little quirky, you know, female, Bacardi Breezer drinking audiences, 3 stars. And I remember being like, hang on, heartbroken. Because I was like, what? Why can't you see what I saw in the room? And I learned very early on that actually it's not about how much you smash it. It's whether or not they identify with you, whether or not you look like them, or whether you sound like them, or whether you act like them. Because that show wasn't a 3-star show. That show went on to tour for 5 years. That show was a super successful show. So it's like when I see reviewers review Beyonce and they give her 3 or 4 stars. And you go, what the fuck? She's Beyonce. Like, why are you giving her 3 or 4 stars? You fucking want? Yeah. No one cares for your opinion. But then the problem is that the good reviews get industry to come and see you. So if the reviewers are the gatekeepers, then that's the first point, isn't it? Because if you've got good reviews, then the industry will come and see you. And if the reviewers look like the industry and the industry look like the reviewers, already you're funneling, you're sieving out a whole group of people, demographic of people that are brilliant. They just look like the status quo.
One of the things I've been trying to work I contacted the LCA to try and see what we could do about that.
What the LCA is, please, just break that down, please.
So it's the Live Comedy Association, and it's basically in response to COVID-19, a load of people from the industry got together and went, we have to try and form some sort of like group that can then go to the government and push for support and help and things. So and they've got representatives who cover, you know, Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland, but they've also got people who deal with like diversity and people who represent the agents and people who represent the comedians. So I messaged, I think it was the representation like wing, and said, I think that we have such a, because I was talking about this with Dane, and that he was saying, just like you're saying, one type of comedy is rewarded in broadsheets and in the comedy industry. And that stuff makes the industry pay attention. Like people will book you off a Guardian review for a television show. They just will.
Crazy, yeah.
And I'm saying that as someone who benefits from whatever I present is acceptable to them. Like whatever I'm doing, like, you know, I have played the system, or because this is what I'm thinking about in relation to you, is they don't know what you are. He doesn't know any woman like you. He doesn't know it. So what he's saying is like to even make any kind of judgments, which is, by the way, absolutely dripping with class hatred about what your audience are drinking. That is not part of the review. Right. He should go, holy shit, this woman is fucking tapped into something. And it might not be me, but like, you know what? If you want this, this, and this, and you're this person, then I think you have found your comedian, is what he should be saying. If there's anything like an experience that he's seeing, like he should be like,
and now I see the reviews and I see the reviews they're giving out, I'm like, oh good, you've learned, you've changed. So you are capable of learning and change.
Yeah. Well, they should, I think one of the things I push for is like, they should have a style guide. They're not capable of writing like with any kind of nuance when it comes to sexuality, when it comes to sexual assault, when it comes to race, when it comes to gender, when it comes to class, like all that kind of stuff. They're sort of dipping their toes in, and they think by being in the media and educated, it's enough, but it's not actually. You should, like, if you're going to go and see a show like that really deals with like queer issues,
yeah,
send a queer reviewer who speaks that language, who, do you know what I mean? Like, understands that world, not someone who's like, oh yeah, you know, like I watched Queer Eye, that's enough. And it's like, no, it's not. Like, you're not even speaking the same language, so you're not bringing the insight that community needs. And not just to give praise, but to critique that properly. If you're not across what is happening in queer politics and queer movement, you cannot critique that piece of art properly. So I think that they should have more specialized journalists when it comes to reviews, especially the broadsheets. That's an obligation that they need to have.
But then the old school argument is, because I remember growing up in comedy, or like when I first started just gigging, the idea was like, well, you should be able to play any room. Like, that's your job as a comedian. You should be able to play any room, any audience. That's your job. And there was more pressure, I think, on the females to be able to do that. Like, I remember when I started, people would say stuff like, oh, you shouldn't wear a dress, or shouldn't wear too much makeup, or shouldn't wear big earrings because it will distract. And I was like, that's bollocks. Like, that's like, I wear that shit at home and I'm funny. Like, that's not what stops me being funny. Like, it's bizarre. But then the old school part of me feels like, oh, well, if they're then specific reviewers, then that's taken away from the idea that you should be able to play any room and you should be able to turn anybody across. But you're right, because when they're reviewing you, they're bringing their bias. So even though you can play to them, and even though you can tour in every pub and room, bubba pub or gay bar up and down a country, in every fancy theatre to make your show as accessible as possible, if they're narrow-minded, and sadly the industry gives a lot of heed to their opinion. So like you say, you can get a TV show booked on it, which is an opportunity. It's a work opportunity is based on that review. So therefore, then it is important to fucking, but then you're appealing to the gatekeeper, which isn't what comedy is about. Comedy is about appealing to everybody, or to, you know, to an audience, not the gatekeeper. That's, we're rebellious. We're the most rebellious art form. That's the point. We're not supposed to play by the fucking rules. That's the whole point, surely.
Yeah. And I think you're so right in what you say about, it's so interesting, the whole you should play any room, because I heard that and I internalized that, which is why I'm always like first to say I came up through the circuit. There's not a single comedy club that I don't play now. And there's not a single fucking dog shit room in the Northwest that I didn't do on the way up. Like, and I did that deliberately, because I'm like, if I do well, I'm not having anyone turn around and imply that I leapfrogged it. Do you know what I mean? Like, because you all saw me at those gigs working my bollocks off to make this happen. But people will still deny you your success, because ultimately, if they think they should be in that position, they will find fault with it. They will find fault with, oh, well, I heard that, you know, that they'll manufacture.
And that white noise is so depressing and so saddening, because you go, where has that come from? And like, I'm not doing that to you, so why are you doing that to me? Because I don't think people realise this game is hard. Whether you've got agent support or you haven't, the game is hard, because ultimately your audience is who can make or break you. Like, ultimately, it's can you do well in front of them? And that's all it should ever be. But I had an amazing conversation with a comic that just kind of blew my mind. And I won't name names, just to whatever, just because it's not about the name, it's just about the principle. But one comic was like a TV comic, newer comic, but he's on TV all the time, presenting shows, always on TV, right? So he's well-known face around the country, but newer, been going maybe like 10 years or whatever, 10 odd years. And the other comic is a veteran, like old school veteran comic, been going around for 25 years, not famous at all, but nobody ever wants to fucking follow him after he plays the Comedy Store, because you just can't follow him, right? And both their names were on a poster. And the new comic and the older comic were both on the poster. And the newer comic said, oh, he's headlining, so he's on the face of all the poster. And he was like, oh, can I not follow? Like, I don't want to follow the old comic. In the old comic, it's like, hang on, you cannot have it both ways. You can't have the TV, have the sellout tours, have the arenas, make all the insane amount of money that you are making, right? And then when it comes down to a gig, say, oh, actually, but I don't want to follow you, the lesser known, unknown comic. Because A, people have come to see the show to see you because your name is on the face of the poster. It's you're the headline spot. So you're the end spot. The headliner is the end traditionally.
Yeah.
You're the headline spot. So then that's going to make it harder for me. If I have to go on after you, A, they've just seen you. They want to see you. They're going to laugh as soon as you say hello because they know you. I then have to work harder to get them on side, and I will smash it. But B, why should I have to? Like, why do I let you get to have both? Like, it's not fair. Like, I'll go on and smash it and do my job, and then it's up to you to follow me. And I was like, you know what? I never thought of it like that, from that perspective of, like, we get so lost in the profile of comedy and the hierarchy of comedy. And actually, when it comes down to the, can you deliver the jokes?
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah, like, I can't, especially not now. I've fucking forgotten how to do fucking comedy, mate. But like, right. And I just thought that was so interesting. That was so interesting to hear that perspective. I hadn't heard that or thought of that perspective before.
Well, I've been running an online gig in all this madness. And one of the things I've noticed is I've deliberately tried to book telly names, sell the tickets, and I've deliberately tried to support someone on the circuit that I think has been hit hard.
Yeah.
And like, they're always the people who smash it the hardest, because there is no one more match fit than a comic who's out gigging five times a week.
Right.
And knows that 20, like, you know, like, knows every moment, every look.
Yeah.
So what's happening is people are coming away. They're coming there to see, you know, Rod Gilbert or whoever. And then they're going, oh my God, I've never seen Jonathan Mayer before. I'm going to go out and see them as soon as I, you know, the world gets back to normal. And it's such a beautiful thing, because you want to go. And this is why it's so important, this conversation at the moment about funding for comedy, because the best comedians, most people have never heard of. Like, and not in the way like Daniel Kitson. I mean, like Jeff Innocent. Like, you know, the most unfollowable, amazing comedian.
Yeah. Yeah.
You would walk past on the street, but that's
like Jeff Innocent, Terry Ordson, like Phil Nichols. Like, there's loads of them that are just fucking...
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Sure, you're an art. To watch you is a fucking education. Like, to watch you,
totally
magic.
Absolutely. Nina Benjamin, like, unfollowable, oh,
ridiculous,
unfollowable. Yeah. Yeah. So we've got all these amazing comics who are just being at the top of their game, and it's like, and maybe they'll get telly, maybe they won't, but it doesn't mean it's so hard. You'll have had this when you're coming up, when you go, you're a comedian, people go, have you been on telly? And you're like, God, that's most people's benchmark. Whereas as a comedian, I was like, as soon as I can pay my bills, I'm a success.
Yeah.
But it's so hard that people will take, and I get why some people get a bit like, not bitter, that's not the right word, but a bit like, where the fuck are they getting that? If you're thinking, they if they get a headline, they can't follow me. I get why there's, because the problem with the circuit is largely a meritocracy. Obviously there's some sexism and things that affects it, but largely, if you smash that room, you will have a full diary. That's just how it works. If you are undeniably good, you will work. It does not mean that, but the problem is telly and radio is not a meritocracy. They want to know what else. Of course you're funny, and it doesn't matter if you're not, because we can pair you with writers, but like, what else are you bringing to, you know, that we want from you? And ultimately, like, the comedy is incredibly ageist, so like, if you are, I'd say, over 45, like, they're probably not going to be very interested in what you have to say. Yeah. It doesn't matter how hard you smash that room, they'll be like, well, it's, you know, we want to get young people to watch. Like, young people weren't watching in that room that Jeff Innocent just destroyed.
Apart from now, like I said to a friend, and her criticism was like, oh, apart from now, you've got the Black Lives Matter movement, and now they're suddenly interested in me, or now they're suddenly thingy, because it makes them look better. And you go, hang on, I've been gigging for fucking years, you've not been interested, and now because it suits your agenda, now you're interested.
Yeah, totally.
It's a weird dynamic. It's a weird industry, and it's weird that it's become so. I felt it in Edinburgh actually this year. Like, for me, it became very insular and very bitchy and very just all about what everybody else is doing in their business, rather than, and it's such a shame that it's come to that, because I don't ever feel, I never grew up in that with comedy. Like, for comedy was always just like, shit, please don't die, please don't die, please don't die, please don't die, just try not to be shit. It was never about the other nonsense or the white noise or who's got what. And it's, you know, it's such a beautiful art form, and it's the most accessible art form, and anyone and everyone can just get up on stage and do it. Like, anyone can. There's no one to say, we don't think your face fits. You're not the right weight. You're not the right size. You're not the right skin color. You're not the right accent. You're not the right thing. Like you say, all you have to do is smash that room.
Yeah.
And you can be, you can have a career out of it.
And that's why it's so jarring, because you come up, like I say, through largely a meritocracy. Like, yeah, you come up and things are like, if you are good and you get better, like, you'll get rewarded with better gigs and paid gigs. And then suddenly you hit this like invisible ceiling that you didn't know was there, where it's like all the things that you can't control about yourself, where you were born, like how rich your parents were, yeah, you know, who you're attracted to, how you identify, they are all suddenly part about the conversation about whether you deserve what comes next.
Yeah.
And that is so, such a head fuck. And you can see that it drives people insane. And it's hard not to, even when you're reaping the benefits, like, you know, I'm really lucky with everything that's happening. It's still hard not to let it drive you insane, because also the other side of it is, you know, and like people have said, but you know, like, there's definitely people who are having the conversation who are as good as me, if not better than me, who started at the same time as me, who are like, well, I wish I had a Fanny and then I'd have her career. Like, because that's the other thing is, yeah, like, you've got it in your head that you only get stuff because of,
what
you're bringing in terms of, and like, what an absolute, like,
reduced like that. You have to be reduced. And maybe there is an element of truth in these things, because when you come to radio and TV, like you say, if I'm saying the gatekeepers are now suddenly interested in my friend, who they weren't interested in years ago, but now because it suits their agenda, they're interested. That there isn't an element of truth to that, where they're picking who it suits their agenda rather than necessarily who's good. And that's kind of, I think, where the change needs to come from. Or the change comes from seeing something like coronavirus and the pandemic, artists taking more control of their own careers and producing their own content and releasing their own content, because it's becoming an open playing field now. Like, it almost doesn't matter now who you're with or what agent you've got, or we have to find our audiences. It's all about finding our audiences. But that's like hard. Like, I've been finding my audiences from day one, and I found myself hitting a ceiling, and it became difficult and things became tricky. And I think because of my background and because I worked so hard independently for everything I got, I was fearful of people. I didn't trust people. So when they were after my shit or wanted to come work with me, I was like, well, I don't trust you. What are you going to bring to me? Like, it's taken me years to get here and no one's given me a fucking leg up. So what are you going to give me? And then that doesn't work, because you're growing up as a stand-up that's quite an isolated profession. And then suddenly you've got to work with a team, like, you know, in suits and producers and people that you're like, okay, I'm going to try and trust you and try and do things, but we have to meet what the commissioner wants, and the commissioner has to find it funny. But the commissioner used to work in documentaries, so what the fuck do they know about stand-up? And they didn't like this joke and they didn't like this. And you're like, oh, well, that's... Well, come watch me in a live show, because I know what I'm doing. Like,
yeah, it is so frustrating. But you're so right. And I kind of think it has been that way for a few years, since I guess podcast is a big thing as well, of like, it's hard because you can build your own audience. Like, but what the difficult thing is so like, I've got this podcast and definitely have built an audience and was touring before. Yeah, that was touring before I should have been allowed to, because I had this audience who would come and see me because they liked what I did, which is so lovely. And then, you know, that audience grows. And so the people that come, but ultimately, if you want it to grow at a rate that's sustainable and is like, you know what, I can now put time into the other stuff, it's telly and radio, the things, because all that happens is, you know, you'll go on something and let's say 8 million people see you. 7 million of them can hate you, but if 100,000 of them are like, great, you have just sold yourself a load of tickets.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? And the rest of that million left over are sort of indifferent. That's what it is. And that's like, I don't think any of us are necessarily going, I should be in stadiums, I belong in this. We're just going, I would just love to play nice full rooms of a couple of hundred. Like, yeah, that's all we want, isn't it? Like, we're not. Right. And I think there's room for everyone, but everyone who's been creative and pushing themselves and reaffirming what their voice is and having like what next, what is pushing themselves forward, deserves that. But it's so hard because, like you say, you're beholden to the gatekeepers. And I think you're right in that coronavirus is forcing people to do stuff online and find their audiences, but it'll become like everything in that. Do you remember at first, if you're really good on Twitter, like you had loads of followers and that meant loads of work.
Yeah,
and then if you're really good on YouTube, that meant loads of, but like,
And then Instagram. And then,
But there's only one Mo Gilligan. Like, there's, you know, there's very few success stories at that level because they're the ones who got in there quickly. Again, like, I think our podcast has been so helpful to us. But, like, now if you start a podcast, and I think you're, it's so crowded there. So you've just got to try and be like, what's coming next, and keep trying these irons. It's
and also coming. That idea, isn't it? By the time everyone jumps on, it's already gone. Because I remember podcasts, for years people have been telling me to do a podcast, and I've been like, no, like, I'm not interested. And now I'm finding myself doing a fucking podcast because coronavirus, and nothing else to fucking do. And I'm like, oh shit, I need to create something somewhere. Like, it's doing it. Like, for me, sadly, like, it's, I love live shows. Like, for me, I love live shows. Live shows are my favorite thing to do, and I feel so lucky and privileged to be able to do them. And all I ever want to do is play to full houses and live shows. Like, I will be so happy if for the rest of my life I can just play full sold out houses. And every year they get bigger and bigger and bigger. But there is something to be said, isn't there? And there's a humbling in comedy. There's a humility, I think, in comedy, because you can always die on your ass, right? So you can always be put back in your place, like, always. So no matter how good you get, or how cocky you get, or how, like, no, you know, people say, they go, oh, have you tried getting on Live at the Apollo? And you go, do you have any idea how fucking hard it is to get on Live at the Apollo? And even when you get that gig, I found it, and I was talking to other comics, it's so hard to smash that gig because you're nervous as fuck. People don't realise the whole room is lit. If you've never played a recorded gig before, normally in a comedy club, is small, skanky, smelly, dark, dingy, sweaty, horrible. Live at the Apollo is clean, massive. You can see the whites of everybody's eye. Like, everyone is there. And you're like, this is so awkward. And the TV's like, rolling, now, go. And you're like, oh no. Like, it's so uncomfortable. But there's a humility in stand-up and comedy as an art form. And I think maybe there is something to be said for that idea. Like, I've certainly had to learn it, of, like, patience, of, like, your time will come. When it's ready, it will come. And it's a case of being ready. If and when it does come, and if it doesn't ever come, then it's finding satisfaction and happiness in what you are able to do, and feeling proud of that. Like, for me, from where I came from to be able to do my shows in theatres, like, I'm really proud of that. Like, that's me living my dream. But then, if I get to in my head, I go, oh, but I'm not successful, and I can't afford a place in London, and I'm not on TV, and I don't know, like, why? Why? Like,
what you always have to remember as well is, like, we are nearly all living someone else's dream career. Like, even if you're, like, if you're doing, like, middling at two mainstream comedy clubs, there's an open spot there who's like, all I want to do is be in the middle at, you know, like, the Comedy Loft and the Frog and Bucket. And so, like, you might be like, oh, I wish I was doing more. I'm not doing that. But, like, everyone else is living someone else's dream.
I need to say that because there's so many clubs that I play that as soon as I've got a live show, they will book me like that. Like, the second I've got a live show, they'll book me like that. And then I go, and then I see their weekend lineups. I'm like, why have you not booked me for a 20-minute spot? A 20-minute spot. And then the comics there are like, are you fucking mad? Do you have any idea how much we want to get off this circuit?
Exactly. Well, you always crave, like, what you don't have as well. So, like, there's people touring shows who are like, oh, I still can't get in at the store or wherever. But then there's people at the store who are like, I don't want to be doing four shows a night on a Saturday. What? I just want to do one in Tunbridge Wells.
Yeah, totally.
500 people or whatever.
And there's so many comics I know that are brilliant, like people like David Haddingham or like Dan Nightingale. These comics are fucking phenomenal and no one's ever heard of them. And it's weird because you see them and you go, oh, well, you can't be that good because you're not on TV. You go, TV's wrong if you're not on it. Like, TV is wrong if you guys aren't on it because you are fucking phenomenal. And like you said, the podcasting thing, it's really lovely because Dan Nightingale and Adam Rowe. Adam, I don't know that well, but Dan I've known fucking forever. And I would argue that Dan Nightingale is the best MC in the country. Like, he's fucking phenomenal. Like, he's just insanely, insanely good. Like, he's just, not even, and it's weird with MCs because people seem to think there's a hierarchy that MC's a comic. He's a brilliant comic. I would argue he's one of the best comics in the country then because he's just brilliant. And no one's ever heard of him. And he set up in his little shed, a little podcast with Adam. And they've just built themselves a little studio. They've just done it themselves with their patrons. They've built it up. Have a word pod. If you're not already subscribed, have listened to them. Have a word pod. And, of course, Kerry's All Killer, No Filler. Like, and there's something to be said for when you say meritocracy. Of that opportunity that we have now that you go, okay, that door's not opening for me, but I can climb through the window. Like there's something I can do here.
Mm.
I think a lot of that is the internet. We've got the internet to thank for that.
But also, like, what you've got to be good at, or you should hone just as much as your material, is look at yourself like an audience member and be like, what do I go when I'm looking for a podcast? What do I search for? What do I want to listen to that isn't there or isn't hitting the mark? Because that's why I basically went to Rachel Fairbairn years ago. Listen, no one is nailing serial killer podcasts in a funny way. Loads of comedians like horror and things. There's a huge overlap. So if we did this well, there's no one else doing it. And lo and behold, it is what it is. Yeah. But the same with like a musical, the show that we were doing was like, I know loads of comedians love musical theatre. Love it, love it, love it. Audiences love musical theatre. It's like all out joyful nerdery. It's Glee Club with your favourite comedians.
Yeah.
And then you build it and they come. And like nearly everything I've done is because there's no one making the thing that I want to see or I want to be a part of. You're like, okay, well, we build it.
Totally. That's how I felt when I first started doing stand-up, because I would do stand-up. And I would play clubs and die my ass, and I couldn't do it. But if there was three people in a room, I could fucking smash it. I knew what to do with three people, right? And then I started playing musical bingo, hosting this thing called musical bingo, where people just got wasted and they hear a song. Whenever they liked, they crossed it off, and if they got three in a row, they'd win a toaster. And they'd go mad for this toaster. People would go mad. And they'd love it. And I'd be like, hang on, how come a joke that I've been doing for 2 years I can get a out of? But I can be like, who wants to win a cheese toastie? Wah! Like, so I was like, how do I get that in stand-up? Because I didn't like watching stand-up. So then the Beyonce show was for me, what's my dream show? I want to sing a bit. I want to cry on stage. I want to mime to Adele. I want to dance to Beyonce. I want to get some people up to dance with me. And I just want to talk about all my issues and my problems. I want people to laugh and soothe me with their balm of laughter and make me feel like actually life's not so shit after all. And that's exactly what I did. And they fucking came, because it was true to myself. It was true to myself. And it was finding the thing that I wanted to watch. And I feel when I see new comics or people try and do things and they go, oh, I saw you talk about your mum passing away. Also, I'm going to talk about my dead grandma. And you go, stop trying to mimic what other people's authenticity or other people's journey. This joke about, oh, everyone does a 40-minute sad bit. I do sad bits in all my shows and I fucking nail them each and every fucking time. Don't come at me with your bullshit. Like, that's on you. Yeah. Like, you can't do it. That's on you. What's your authentic voice? If your authentic voice is not to have a 40-minute sad bit, don't fucking put one in, because you think what you should do.
Exactly. Like,
just there's the desire or the drive to stay authentic in a world or an industry that you go, oh, well, that's doing well, so I should do more of that. It's like, wait, is that me with podcasts? Oh, podcasts are doing well. I should do a podcast. Like, fucking never done a podcast in my life, mate. Like, what the fuck am I doing? Like,
but that just means you're not going about it in the way, the conventional wisdom, which would be where you get a producer and it has to have musical stings and it's 30 minutes and there's got to be these. You're doing your own version of it. So you can take the medium and then do your own version.
Your own version, which is what we should all be able to do. Yeah. Like, saying no to anything. But it's just saying, okay, what's your version of that look like? Like, for me, it's me sat here to you where you're in a dressing gown and I'm in my pants and we're recording it and all they can hear is the audio, which is such a shame because we look terrific right now. this should be extra money.
But you're totally right. And you know what? That's actually the most difficult thing in comedy is identifying yourself as an audience. What are you not seeing that you want to build, but staying true to yourself? So not just going, so like, when I was coming up, obviously, don't stand by this now, but like, I loved Louis C.K. and I loved what he did in terms of really skirting on the edges of being like pushing things, but also ultimately, obviously, we now know it's a lie, but like having the morality of someone who's just trying to get it right. Like, he was ultimately a good guy, which is why his comedy doesn't work now, because we know he wasn't.
Yeah.
So I was like, that stuff excites me because he's talking about difficult stuff and you trust him to go there and even push the envelope because you know he ultimately is doing the right thing. And I was like, that stuff's exciting for me. But what I didn't do is go, I'm going to just go and write some Louis C.K. jokes. I'm like, right, how does that truth of what he's doing relate to me and what I want to talk about?
Yeah.
And that's the hardest thing is, so what you have is loads of people being like, you know, loads at the moment of people kind of aping American Bill Burr, say it like it is comedians, who are often, all it means is that they're making loads of really horrible jokes about trans people. And it's like, that's not why Bill Burr is successful. You're just trying to copy it onto you. And ultimately, there's nothing authentic there. So you're not going to build fans. If you are yourself, you build fans. Like, Harriet Dyer is someone I think of is like so weird and wonderful.
Yeah,
would die a lot. But she would walk away with like 10 people from every gig who are then obsessed and her biggest fans.
Yeah, she's amazing.
Yeah, and that's, you know what I decided a few years ago is when I was thinking about all this, I was like, you know what, the more I am me and talk about the stuff I want to do and not I think I should, and the things that are hard to make funny, but if I pull them off, I'm really proud of myself. That's how you become someone's favorite comedian. I don't want to be like, and that's how I want to be someone's favorite comedian.
Always. And I think that's a really lovely goal. And actually, in the grand scheme of things, surely that's better to be rather than just, not that it's great to sell out, it'd be great to sell out, but if sellout doesn't happen, or if these things or TV audits doesn't happen, but if you've got a room full of people that fucking love you and adore you, you'll have a career for life. And that's all you need, isn't it? You just need a room full of people that will support you, that will grow with you, that will love what you do. And surely that's what art is about, isn't it? Or that's the whole point, because we are vulnerable. Like, comics are so fucking, we're so fucked up. We're so odd and insular and little weirdos. Like, I have so much respect for comedians because all of us are so fucking odd. We're just trying our best to fucking get through life and survive it. And we think that for some reason, talking to a room full of strangers about it will make them laugh. Like, it's such a weird... I know I've got friends that say stuff like, oh, I could never do what you do. Like, I could never do what you do. I could never get up and do that. So brave. That's so brave. And you go, I could never, like, fucking go on a date with a guy and be normal and have somebody that's interested. Like, what the fuck? How do you... Oh, I end up pouring a cocktail on my face because I'm like, I don't know how to engage in this. Sorry. Like, I just don't know what I'm meant to do on this. But going on stage and be like, trying to be funny. Yeah, I'll die my ass sometimes, but it's cool. It's part of the process. Like, it is what it is. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's part of the story. So it's just what we find comfortable. And I love our art form, and I think our art form is so important and so intrinsic to the mental health and the mental well-being of our communities and our societies, because I know from touring up and down the country, as you do, the different places you go to, like, everyone is different, whether you go to fucking Kidderminster or Kettering, or whether you're playing in Soho Theatre or London. All these communities, most people are good people, most people are good, loving, hardworking, beautiful people. And to be able to be with them and make them laugh and make them think about things a bit and change their opinion of themselves or make them feel better. It's such a beautiful thing to be able to do. And we and our voices affect groups of people. We start little economies. Every time we go to a gig, we have a mini economy, because thanks to us playing that night, the venue is hired. There's bar staff there. There's security staff there. There's cleaners working that night. There's alcohol being sold. And there's audiences going away, and they'll tell their person about the next day, oh my God, I saw this person and they were brilliant last night, or they did this thing, or oh, I didn't like this joke, or whatever it is that they want to do. And we've affected them. And yet our industry, for all the wealth and money it creates, I'm sure we create a fucking lot. I've seen it because I've seen my theatre tour breakdowns. We fucking generate a lot of fucking money for other people. Right? For us to not be supported now coronavirus has hit is really heartbreaking, because fundamentally we are the people that hold power to account.
Yeah,
in front of the king that go, we're going to do jokes about the king to the king, but the king doesn't know they're about him, but everybody else does. Ha, 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 ha. And we're the ones that are getting just annihilated, decimated. And like you say, it's going to be the working class people and working class comics, because do you want to see a room full of comedy of people that have been able to fucking not work and do what they want until they're 35 because their parents pay for it, then they buy them a flat in London, then they can gig whenever they want because they've got everything already. You know, sure, there are some brilliant ones, but where's the fun in that? Surely you want the variety, you want the oddballs, you want the fucking weirdos coming on stage that fucking kill a room in terms of making dead, but three people are howling because they're like, what the fuck am I watching? Like, you want that.
Yeah.
You want that.
And also those people who have been able to get where they get because of their parents' connection and stuff, like, they're already running the country. We don't need them in comedy. Do you know what I mean? They've already got all the power, and all we've got is the, like you say, our power is trying to change minds or open up conversations. So yeah, I think it would be really sad. Here's something I wanted to ask you, if that's, am I allowed to ask you stuff?
Yeah, always go for it.
Because, you know, when you do comedy and, like, you get to your own, like, milestones, and then, like, there's it never stops being hard because you can never complete comedy. That's what I think. There's no like CEO of comedy. Well, maybe Billy Connolly, but that's it. But, like, you know, there's no top boss level. Yeah. So one of the things is like new challenges at each level. So that's like things like, so when you start off, it's like playing the clubs, but keeping your voice. So not just playing stuff you think that, you know, audiences, are, but every step you hit something new. And so the thing that I'm at now is that I'm thinking about like long-term, how do I do this? Is like, how do I keep making shows that I'm proud of, mm-hmm. that my audiences like, but without pandering to them? So do you know what I mean? Like some comedians I've looked at and I really admire, and I'm like, you're writing a show that they want to hear. I don't know that this is what you want to say at this point.
Yeah.
Oh, say this, my audience will. So how much is it our responsibility to push that? Or do you feel like, you know what, I'm so grateful for you, I'll whatever you want me to do, I'll just keep doing it. Like, is that something you think about?
It's something. So I had three shows and two were very similar vibe in terms of they were very party, in your face, gregarious, like talked about serious stuff, but were very in your face party shows. And then the politics show was totally left field and not the kind of show I wanted to make or that I wanted to do. And it certainly didn't necessarily appeal to my audiences the way I wanted it to, or not the way that I would want it to, or the way that initially that I'd be like, I'm going to make a politics show for these girls that came to see about thigh gaps and Beyonce and sucking dick. Like, I'm going to talk about Boris Johnson and Brexit. What the fuck?
Your BBC Three series was fucking incredible, by the way.
Oh, thank you. So I had a lot of frustrations with that series because I felt like I probably didn't want to. I wasn't ready to make it. Like, I was so caught up with things that just happened. My mum had just passed and I was so raw and so it was so difficult for me to see the wood for the trees. And so I was so angry when I made that series about everything. So it was very difficult for me to disassociate and be a bit more laid bare. Whereas with the live show, I could be really fucking angry on stage. Like, I could be really angry and whatever. And that served its purpose. But I always remember, like, Debbie Allen said to me, she said, a good comic will always be good because whether they like you now, whether you're talking about thigh gaps or Beyonce, when you have babies or are married with a husband, your audiences will also then be married or meeting somebody or having babies. So they will grow with you. So then you will find funny in that. So actually, it's not about pandering to them, because I felt that often, especially with the politics show. I was like, well, I've got to take my clothes off, or I've got to do a dick joke, or I've got to have a musical dance off bit, like I have to throw that in, otherwise they'll leave. And what I learned was is that people will follow you, and if they know you and they know your voice, they'll follow your journey because you're good. So as long as you're good and you're you and you're authentic, you'll lose some people, like you always do, but then you'll gain some others. And it will change. And like now, it's for me with my new show, I kind of want to get back to the older vibes where it is a bit more party and a bit more fun, just because doing a fucking show about politics for 2 years is fucking boring and long. I wanted to kill myself afterwards. I was like, fuck this for a fucking barrel of laughs. Like, listen, you can have it. Like, all you political, like, what's his name? Whatever his name is, like, politics guys, you can have it. You can have that remit. Like, I'm done. But then I'm also proud because I'm like, right, I can do a show about Beyonce, I can do a show about politics, and I can do a show about religion. Get you a bitch that can do all three. Like, it's cool. Like, so I think as long as you're authentic to you and what you want to talk about, because what you don't want to do is get bored. Mm. If you're bored of what you're doing or what you're talking about, they'll smell it. They're
amazing at that, aren't they? This audiences are so perceptive. So perceptive.
Like, their sense of smell is ridiculous for fear or for inauthenticity. Like, they, and you know it as well. Like, I've gone on stage before, like at a club gig, and I go, I'm going to dumb ass, and I start talking, and they're like, what the fuck? And I'm like, I know this is going horribly wrong. Oh God, somebody shoot me in the face. And they're like, oh, this is so weird. And you're like, oh, this, and it's totally in your head. I've totally gone out there and messed it up for myself because I was in my own head and I knew I was going to die. Whereas with the live show, I'm like, oh, you bitches ain't ready. You fucking sit down and wait for this, you motherfuckers. And they're like, oh, we can't wait to see what she's going to do for us. We love you, Louisa. Yes. Like, they smell it. They smell it a mile off, always. I just thine own self be true, mate. And I think thine own self be true. And yes, you might lose people by doing things slightly differently, but you will gain a whole new load. And then what you want to do is look back at your body of work and see that you've grown and see what you've created and be proud of that. like, it's weird because when you see musicians and they have a dodgy album, they go, I really needed to write that album because it was my left field album. And all the audience are like, oh, fucking hell, everybody hated that album. It was such bullshit. Like, we prefer the pop shit that you did. Like Mariah Carey, when she did her power ballads, then she went all weird with this fucking rap stuff that she started doing in the fucking 2000s. You were like, what? There was that We Belong Together song, the one good power ballad, and everything else. You're like, Mariah, what the fuck are you doing? Go back to singing Vision of Love. Do you know what I mean? Like, what the fuck are you doing? But it was important for her to do it for growth. Like, it's important for all artists. So. Mm. But I don't know if it's the right, I don't know. Like, genuinely, I don't know. I think that's all we can do and just hope that people will still come. If by all means your new version of art means nobody comes along and you don't get paid and you can't pay your rent or your mortgage, maybe bow a little bit.
There's a compromise there, isn't there?
Yeah, there's a compromise to be made there. Yeah, it's a bit like, oh, but with all my shows, like, I always start with dick jokes. I'm like, here's the penis material, whoa, penises. And then I can be like, right, male suicide, the referendum, let's go. Like, because I've got them in. So it's just working out, isn't it? A way to let them recognize you.
Yeah.
But be authentic to who you are now. Because you're going to change. You're going to change throughout your life. You're going to become such a different person every time something happens to you or every time that you experience something, you're going to change and grow.
Yeah.
I just hope that the theatre survive and, you know, they let us see it. They let us show it.
Mm.
It's a weird, scary time.
It is. And I don't think people realise, like, how... Well, generally, like, I'm really pro small business. I always have been, but this coronavirus especially, because I just saw how much small businesses... I'm literally talking about, like, a woman sewing things in her spare bedroom around bringing up her three kids. How much they did, how much they gave to charity, how much they donated, how much of their time they did, and juggling everything. Mm-hmm. So I'm so small, like, so pro small business, but also comedians in terms of, like, the thing is, if you spend with small businesses, they put it back into the community. Big businesses take it out. Billionaires extract it and they sit on it like dragons on coins, right? But if you spend your money, like, with a comedian, if you come to see me on tour, know that I have paid a director, know that I'm paying an agent, know that I'm paying a producer, know that I'm paying the staff of everyone who's in that venue for that show, know that I paid someone to make my costume because that stuff's important to me, yeah. Know that I paid a photographer, know that I paid a makeup artist, know that I paid a graphic designer. Like, yeah. Know that, like, you know, all this.
There's a whole team behind you that people don't
realize. That support act I've sought out and I'm paying them properly to do their job
and their travel and their accommodation, like, that shit's expensive. Yeah,
exactly. So, like, this thing of being like, I am, yeah, that basically is like, you're not just, when you're giving that 14 quid over or whatever, you're not, it's not all going to me. Like, I immediately, it all gets spent out again and I'm like supporting a larger economy. And like,
and people don't realize, they always go, oh, well, you got 14 people, you've got 100 people here, that's like 1,400 quid in your pocket. And you're like, my support act took home more money than I did for the hour show today.
like
because you do. And I think hopefully people will realise that and see that. And audiences are lovely. Like, you know, like, Patreon has been amazing for me. Like, I've been so lucky and thankful to have Patreon because I'd be fucked without it. Just people that have been in audience have gone, we'll give you £3 a month. Like, we like what you do. Keep coming on and talking to us and supporting us. Like,
they paid my mortgage.
Literally. Wonderful. Yeah. It's wonderful. It's just such a shame that those in power and the money being spent and the money that we're seeing given to contracts to limited companies that have never got any experience in, you know, distributing PPE are suddenly getting £150 million contracts to distribute PPE. But the arts, like, there's one thing that England is that we should be proud of is our sense of humour. Like, we've got a phenomenal sense of humour. The reason Trump is so horrific, I would argue one of the fundamental reasons, he has no sense of humour. That's, like, he literally has none. England is brilliant for sense of humour. The films we've released, the TV shows, the content, the humour, the stand-ups, the comedy, whether you know them or don't, the stand-ups. The British sense of humour is amazing and it would be such a shame.
Yeah, it's one of the only things that we can export to a global level that we're world leaders in. And like this, like, it's, we're not, you know, like, we've got no Silicon Valley here, but what we have is this incredible weird island. For a start, you've got fucking loads of country smashed into this one little island.
Yeah.
All these cities, which, by the way, even if they're half an hour apart, Liverpool, Manchester, don't want anything to do with each other. You can run fucking four gigs a night in both of them. You're also, if you're a comedian, you can do all those gigs. That's why we've got this amazing circuit.
Yeah.
amazing comedy.
We've got the best circuit in the world. Like, I've done comedy in a few countries. England, for sure, has one of the best circuits in the world. It's amazing.
Of course it is, because it's so small. Like, what is a weird, like, fault of ours of being tiny is a weird thing that makes comedy so brilliant here. And the fact that it's being treated with such, it's not even contempt. It's like we don't even exist. And it's like, so part of me wants to be like, well, I pay fucking loads in tax. Yeah. So I'll just hold on to that and I'll redistribute that as I celebrate.
But that's the thing, because I know they're talking about raising the taxes. And I'm like, why the fuck should I give you any fucking more money than I have? Like, fuck you. Like, what have you done to help me and Marla? Like, what have you done?
Yeah.
It's interesting that you say, because I remember when I was in the US or speaking to like a US comic or like an Australian comic, and they'd be like, oh, I've got to do 6 hours, a 6 hour drive for a 10 minute spot. And I used to complain about doing like an hour and a half on a train for a 10 minute spot, let alone a fucking 6 hour drive for an open spot to spend to speak to like 12 people in a fucking room above a pub. We literally have got the best fucking circuit here. And I really hope that when this is all over and there's a vaccine in place, it's back to normal. Like, I hope comedy fucking booms, because we're going to need a sense of humour to deal with the dog shite that this government is doing.
Yeah, and also there's the thing, we're also focused on, like, just getting through this, when stuff going to open, when we're going to start making money again, you know, like, we all want work. We haven't even begun to deal with the huge collective mourning that we're going to have to do of those, 45,000 people who have died since this started. Like, we haven't even
more. It's going to be more. It's going to be so much more.
We haven't even begun to process that. And who, and what do the, what is the, like, phrase that Britain's famous for? It's gallows humour. It's the people, like, and you need us for that. And so the fact that it feels like, apart from the fans, like, that you can really connect with, that higher up, no one is give a flying fuck to what it's doing to our self-esteem, not being able to do our jobs, but we're the first jobs to go, the last ones to come back, that there's very little financial support available, that we also are trying to do, like, the people who've helped comedians most are the comedians, giving them money, giving them work, making our own industry. And we've never asked for handouts before. We've just fucking got on with it and created this huge thing that makes everyone up there loads of fucking, like, how much money even would have Mickey Flanagan's tour made HMRC? Unbelievable amounts of money. And that's one.
And not just HMRC, but also the alcohol. Like, how much VAT did you charge on the alcohol for everybody that bought a drink at one of those shows? Like, you're not just talking about the actual ticket price. You're talking about, you know, the insurance, the PRS, the fucking, the food, the beverages, the car park, the fucking car park. How much money did you make from the car park?
Yeah, exactly. And then to be treated like you're not even on the list is...
an art form. But even from our own, like, the Arts Council, like, oh, it's not an art form. Like, it's the most fucking rebellious, precious, beautiful, purest art form you could possibly find.
Also, like it feels like we're punished for being...
swearing and saying cunt a few times. Like, fuck.
It would be fine if you said cunt a few times if you were, like, naked and it was in a play and you were actually privately educated. I think
the bin over your head, the red light shining in your feet, and be like, cunt, cunt, cunt. Oh, my God, it's so profound. Yeah.
But because we are, like, we make money, like, we don't, you know, like, for every opera chair is massively subsidised. And I'm not saying opera shouldn't be subsidised, but because we are accessible and we're seen as cheap, even though we're not, if you've ever been to the Edinburgh fucking Fringe Festival, because when it's seen accessible and profitable, we're not an art form. That's absolutely mad. It's like, no, we've just worked out how to make what we do bring people together. And I'm sorry that theatre is so fucking entrenched in class snobbery and racism and sexism that it hasn't worked out how to make people watch its stuff unless it's on telly. But, like, well, that's your fuck up. We deserve a little bit of financial help during all this. But
because we're the ones that are in a room above a pub for free with a bucket at the end and saying anyone is welcome. And if you can't afford it, don't. Have a good night. Thank you for coming. Tell your friends about me.
Yeah. And also, like, part of me wants to be like, hey, theatres, if comedians stopped playing you, your theatres wouldn't stay open. Do you know what I mean? All these drama companies that are going to get loads of funding and all these theatres and arts venues, like, we are fucking, all you have to pay is one technician. We need a mic and a stand and maybe a table and maybe a bottle of water. We will charge us back at the end of it. We don't have get-ins of hours and hours. We don't have huge sets. We don't have a huge cast. You don't have to get extra this and that. We just turn up, we sell a fucking shitload of tickets, and then we go away again. And the fact that we'd be treated like assholes who don't deserve anything is so upsetting and so frustrating.
It's going to be interesting, I think, the fringes that we come back and up through. I feel like it's going to go back to basics almost, like car park gigs or, you know, pub gigs or gay bar gigs. It's going to go back to, you know, like, not waterholes, waterhole gigs, but, like, I feel like it's going to change. It's going to be grassroots again. And we're ready for it, because if there's one thing that comics are, especially if you've grown up in the UK and you've gone through the fringe system and gone through Edinburgh several years in a row, is we're resilient fuckers. Yeah. We're resilient fuckers, and we make it work, and we look after each other, and we play the unplayable. Like, we play unplayable fucking rooms. We play fucking asbestos riddled caves that are freezing that you get pneumonia from. Like, somebody said, oh, why didn't they just go ahead with Edinburgh this year? Like, if they're allowed fucking, you know, if they're allowed people in on a plane. And I'm like, everyone gets pneumonia in Edinburgh as it is. We don't need to, like, that shit will spread like wildfire. Like, no.
One spank show and everyone's got it.
Right, everyone is gone, mate. Everyone is gone. Oh, well, listen, thank you so much for talking to me, Kiri. It's so nice to talk to you. Is there anything that you want to shout about that can make you any money whatsoever? Anything?
I don't make any money from it, but yeah, my digital gig is every month now, the COVID Arms. And I think it's a really fun community that we've built. And my main thing is like, the more tickets we sell, yes, we give to food banks, but we've given like over 100 grand to them already. So I'm like, even if we never give another penny, it's amazing. But it's like
100 grand from this gig.
Over 100 grand, yeah. And the rest has gone to comedians and musicians. So like, the basically every pound I can put in at the pocket of a comedian I know struggling, like, is like, I've done what I can. Yeah. So yeah, it's every month, and Comedy at the COVID Arms. Yeah.
That's amazing. Tune in. What day is it on? Do you know, like, what dates is it, like,
Saturday, every day? So this coming Saturday, and then I think it's like August 16th.
Who have you got this Saturday?
This Saturday, we've got Jason Manford, Jordan Brooks, and Sakisa. Have you met Sakisa? She's so good. Like, I just started working with her. I did that Always Be Comedy gig, and she's just fucking great. Like, yeah, she sometimes goes by Twix, so that I knew her as Twix, and now, but it's Sakisa is her stage name. She's just brill of, like, an act that I met at, you know, like, some hellish run through for something. Right?
Yes, and then relationships form in those places, don't they?
Oh my god, yeah, it's horrific. It's like summer camp, but yeah, like, when you're like, oh, I've got no friends. Yeah.
It's gonna be a good one. Okay, so check it out, the COVID Arms. Yeah, the COVID Arms. COVID Arms, yeah. Mate, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thanks, love. Cheers.
This podcast was sponsored by me, Bunny. Thank you so much for listening. Tell your friends about me, and I'll see you next time. Maybe you could bring me some, I don't know, some chicken or some cake or some bread. Or I love everything. I love you. Bye. Oh, here comes the musical bit.